Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back to Your Cases on Hold, episode 5-2. I'm Dr. Antonia Chen, deputy editor of Adult Reconstruction. I don't know why I said doctor, but I did. Clearly, I just came from clinical work. And you are?
I'm Professor Andrew Schoenfeld. I said professor because I came from research work. Just to follow on, deputy editor for Professor Andrew Schoenfeld, MD. I'm a professional doctor. And I'm
the deputy editor. I didn't play one on TV. Is that okay?
No, I'm a professional doctor. And I'm the deputy editor of Methods at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. This is the February 20th. We're dropping February 20th for the February 21st issue. That's my wife's birthday. So happy birthday, Aaron. And shout out to our colleague, Marco Ferroni, who it's also his birthday. Birthday buddies.
Love the birthday buddies. It works really well. The opinions here are all of our own. They do not represent anyone in JBJS or the editorial board or anyone else who works there on the staff. This is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. So definitely get your learning on. Lots of good opportunities for step one and step two. Without further ado, we're going to start off with our top of the pile. What's new in pediatric orthopedics by Hardse? It's permanently free. There are three evidence-based orthopedic articles, including determining the optimal treatment for idiopathic clubfoot, a network meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials by Wang. What's important? Two chairs, a conversation about patient-centered care and professionalism by Coop and all. It is permanently free.
That was Zach Galifianakis's other YouTube short, In Between Two Chairs. Between two ferns, between two chairs, between two Rexes.
That's a pretty good analogy. I like that. Things to hold on to. One World Surgery, the evolution of a locally run surgical mission in Honduras by Overman. Two chairs, One World Surgery. I mean, I'm liking this number theme here. This is good. An increasing burden of upper extremity fractures in the Middle East and North Africa and MENA. A 30-year analysis of the epidemiology and cause of injury by Hodevecki et al. Headlines. Why don't you start us off by telling us about the cost and outcomes of total joint arthroplasty and Medicare beneficiaries are not meaningfully associated with industry payments by Wadhwa et al. And again, don't listen to us. There's a commentary associated with this as well.
All right. This is an interesting premise. I found it to be an interesting work. They used open payments data and a 20% sample of Medicare insured patients to evaluate the association between industry payments to surgeons, and then sort of the costs and outcomes, at least those that can be measured through Medicare claims data. I think the premise here is one that I personally think is kind of overplayed in the popular consciousness, which is that like physicians and surgeons who are paid by industry are, you know, somehow like nefarious and underhanded, like they're doing something under the table because they get industry payments. I really don't, you know, in my experience, with the surgeons who I've interacted with, who, you know, get lots and lots of money from industry, like Dr. Chen, for example. No, just kidding. Just kidding. but anyway,
you're not watching. My eyes just went wide, but keep on going.
surgeons who do receive industry payments or, you know, have known associations or do consulting for industry or things like that. And those who don't, I have not found that their practices are decidedly different. That may have been, you know, something several decades ago that could have been more of a concern. I think it definitely has continued to play out in the popular consciousness. But also the question that I thought they were asking is kind of a little bit off base here. Because so is the idea that the surgeons who get the industry payments are somehow going to have higher costs or better outcomes, you certainly wouldn't think it would be lower costs, but a lot of times they tend to be like, we'll just call them celebrity surgeons. So, you know, surgeons who are at the top of their game. So are they going to have better outcomes because they're getting, you know, it's not because of the industry payments. It's going to be that there's, you know, an association between their stature and the industry payments. I think the idea is that they're going to use more costly implants, but a lot of times, I don't think it works that way for a couple of reasons. One, just the way things are structured, you may be working at a hospital and they have, you know, certain restrictions on which implants you can use. And if that's a company that you're consulting with, then that works fine, but it's not going to encourage you to use those implants more or use different implants. Plus, there's sort of a ceiling effect there as well. For example, if you're doing, we'll just say spine, because that's my area. If you're doing a case and the patient has a one-level spondylolisthesis and you're going to do an interbody fusion, we'll say MIS interbody fusion, and you want to use a certain company's implant, there's going to be a ceiling to what you can use. You're not going to do a scoliosis T1 to the pelvis pan spinal fusion or a vertebrectomy case for that with a giant construct. You're limited in what you can do based on the indication. It's the same thing with total joints, I would imagine. Like if you're going to do a hip replacement, you're going to use an appropriate implant. You're not going to do a total femur. You're going to take out the whole femur and put in, you know, because you were involved in the total femoral implant design or you're partnering with that, you know, particular industry. So I think there's some ceiling effects to this. And what I would say, again, if you're going to play devil's advocate, and please, listeners, Dr. Chen, don't take this like the wrong way that I'm saying this is a real fact, because I'm not. But I'm just saying in a hypothetical sense, you know, for the individuals who are partnering with industry, if you're talking about on a case-by-case basis, there's not going to be that much different in the margins in terms of what you might select. But if we're talking about volume, there is a difference, right? So what we would be looking at here, what we would be concerned about here is more volume-driven differences. Does, you know, if you are partnered with, you know, industry and you're driven to have, you know, broader indications so that you can get more cases to continue to support your arrangement, that I think is not something that can be measured here. One, they're only using Medicare, so you're not seeing any of the patients that these folks are doing where they may be doing the surgical interventions outside of Medicare. You know, if it's through other insured or cash only or what have you. And then on top of that, it's only a 20% sample. So there may be, you know, surgeons who are drastically underrepresented in this cohort. And some of the highest flyers may not be showing up in it at all. So, you know, long story short, they found that most arthroplasty surgeons received industry payments. A minority of the surgeons received the majority of payments, and costs and outcomes were not meaningfully impacted by industry relationships. I think the causal pathways are not really examined. I agree with the findings, but I think, and I do think these hold up, but I think that the causal pathways that are just not there to explore this to the depth that probably when they originally postulated the question, they might have been hoping to plumb. They wanted to reach depths that you cannot with this data set.
I'm just smiling and nodding because this is very interesting to me. I like the intro because that's really all the preface of what we're getting down to. Normally we delve into the methodology, all the other stuff before the premise of the actual article itself. And so I completely concur with you. It's an interesting study in general because it looks at an area that people are always talking about when it comes to industry payments. But at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily have a big impact. So we can both be bad cops on this one.
Well, no, I mean, I think from a, there isn't anything inherently wrong with the work. I think we're both recognizing like it's an interesting question. It's something that, you know, sometimes we publish things, and I'm using the royal we here because I don't have editorial control over what's get published in JBJS, and neither does Dr. Chen, but we publish things because they are important to get the conversation going in the community. That's one of the, you know, interest to the community, methodologically sound, where there's nothing methodologically improper about it. And, you know, a conclusion that I think is helpful for our discipline.
And I think one of the things that it could have borne from too, is sometimes I'll have patients who'll be like, oh, you know, are you doing this because of that? Or, you know, we read in these newspapers, and there's also, you know, those fantastical journals that say, you know, blah, 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 receives X million of dollars. And that's why an outcome is like, well, it's saying here that it's not tied to that. And it's true. We're all capitated by most of our costs and implant usages are by where we are. So that doesn't necessarily make a difference per se.
And Smith and Nephew, you know what my Bahamian offshore account number is. So.
Oh, I have a Georgia one. I went for a different country. All right, I'm going to switch to something very different and talk about intermediate to long-term results following traumatic hip dislocation, characteristics, CT-based analysis, and patient-reported outcomes. This is by Jaker et al., and there's a visual summary with this as well. But traumatic hip dislocations typically happen from high energy injuries. 90% of the time, it's a posterior dislocation, and they typically happen with a large force directed against the flexed knee with the hip flexed, adducted, and internally rotated. And actually, we don't typically have intermediate or long-term follow-up after these traumatic hip dislocations. So it's kind of nice to see this. A lot of times we see traumatic hip dislocations as a result of undergoing total hip arthroplasty. So you're looking at all these total hip arthroplasty patients, and we're looking at back at why their cause of undergoing total hip is, and one would be post-traumatic arthritis. And one of the post-traumatic reasons could be a dislocation. But this is looking specifically at traumatic dislocations. And we want to see if they've improved. And we don't have a lot of good information about this patient population, so I like that about this study. So the purpose of the study were to analyze the mechanism of trauma, the type of dislocation, concomitant injuries, treatment, and complications for patients with traumatic hip dislocations, and to evaluate PROMs over a 12-year period with a minimum of 2-year follow-up, which is pretty nice. It was a retrospective study. There were 3 level 1 trauma centers contained in the study. From 2009 and 2021, these patients were looked at. And again, you need a minimum of 2-year follow-up. And patients had to be greater than 18 years old, had closed growth plates at the time of injury, knowing that some of these patients could be traumatic injuries due to, you know, car accidents. So it could be younger than 18 and have open physis. Treatment of either an isolated traumatic hip dislocation as a complete loss of contact between the femoral head and the acetabulum, and a traumatic hip dislocation with a concomitant femoral head fracture, the Pipkin types 1-4, or a dislocation-induced avulsion fracture of the acetabular rim. They did look at any sort of history after the injury, so events of redislocation, any sort of hip instability, the development of osteonecrosis or post-traumatic arthritis, subsequent surgical procedures, residual nerve injury, and even sexual dysfunction such as erectile dysfunction or loss of libido. They did look at level of sport before and after the injury, the ability to return to previous level of sports, and the ability to return to work. And they did look at activity levels such as the Tegner activity score and modified Harris-Hip score, so included those PROMs. It only included 112 patients, which is a pretty good population size, actually, given that not that as many people present with traumatic hip dislocations. And there were more men than women, 77% men versus 23% women. As expected, most of the patients underwent a high energy mechanism, 80%, and most of those were motorcycle accidents. The minor trauma was 12%, and isolated sports injury was 9%. There was a high level of concomitant acetabular rim fractures and femoral head fractures in 84% of the patients. The rim fractures were 44%, and the femoral head fractures were 40% of patients. And concomitant injuries occurred in 67% of the patients, most commonly involving the knee, which is 29% of patients. Most of the patients had their hip reduced within 6 hours after the injury. That was 81%. Between 6 and 12 hours was 7%. And then between 12 and 24 hours was 4%. And then greater than 24 hours was 8%. Most of them were managed with primary closed reduction at 75% with the use of anesthesia and muscle relaxant. 21% had primary open reduction, and 4% were managed with open reduction with more. So it wasn't just a primary open reduction. For follow-up, as is pretty typical in our trauma population, only 61% were available for follow-up, and the mean duration of follow-up was 6 years. In that time frame, only one patient redislocated, which was 1.4%. 9 patients had residual instability, and 9 patients, or 13% of patients, had increased risk of osteonecrosis. These patients also tended to be older. Post-traumatic arthritis developed in almost 32% of patients, and these were both independent of the timing of the hip reduction, you know, during the time of when they dislocated and when they were reduced. And 19% of the patients underwent subsequent total hip arthroplasty. Sciatic nerve injury was pretty common in 27.5% of the patients at follow-up. And the both total hip undergoing a total hip replacement and a sciatic nerve injury were associated with both posterior acetabular rim or Pipkin type 4 fractures. Sadly enough, only 33% of the patients returned to their pre-injury level of sport. Only 25% did not return to work, and 27.5% reported having sexual dysfunction. PROM scores were significantly worse in patients with osteonecrosis, post-traumatic arthritis, or residual sciatic nerve injury, and almost 60% of the patients had good to excellent results in terms of the modified Harris-Hip score, which 25% had poor results. They did do multivariable analysis that showed that clinical outcomes were independent of age, sex, type of dislocation, and the severity of concomitant injuries overall, and knee injuries specifically. So basically, this study has shown that post-traumatic hip dislocation did have limitations with overall function. It showed that with regards to sports, work, and sexual dysfunction. And those patients who had concomitant injuries, which was 84, very high percentage, with acetabular rim fractures, but specifically Pipkin 4 fractures, were more likely to undergo total hip arthroplasty for osteonecrosis or post-traumatic osteoarthritis, and they were at greater risk for sustaining a sciatic nerve injury. So my take home from this is really, it's a good study to tell patients what to expect in the future based on your fracture pattern when you present at a trauma center. That said, it only included 112 patients. So this would be much nicer to see on a bigger scale. I do like the longer term follow-up with this, and it's great to keep following these patients over a period of time.
Yeah, the results are really very sobering, and it may be helpful to inform patients so they know what to expect. But in a lot of cases, unfortunately, what is expected, particularly in the more serious ones, is potentially more surgery, sciatic nerve injury. The drivers of adverse outcomes are really not surprising. I would say, again, as you pointed out, it's a limited sample with just 112 patients. So their multivariable analysis is likely underpowered to detect secondary effects. So they're saying there are no differences. With what it really is that their sample is probably not large enough to allow them to adequately detect the drivers. I think there are some signals there that suggest there are drivers of those outcomes. But an interesting retrospective, appropriately graded level 4 study. These are not common injuries, and you're going to need a very large tertiary, large catchment area type trauma center to collect enough. And the fact that they did the longer term follow up and were able to do that is I think the real advantageous aspect of that work.
I like it. This one I'm going to need your help on. Let me tell you, we're going to talk about higher blood glucose levels on the day.
I need your help on this one, actually.
Good. This is going to be a good combined effort. So the one we're going to talk about is higher blood glucose levels on the day of surgery associated with an increased risk of periprosthetic joint infection after total hip arthroplasty by Weir et al. There's a commentary and an infographic on it. So the question is, do blood glucose levels on the day of surgery, do they increase the risk of periprosthetic joint infection? And what are those levels? We previously did work on it when we looked at the day after surgery. People have looked at it preoperatively. This one's looking at the day of surgery. This is using the Premier Healthcare Database, looking from January 2016 to December 2021, elective procedures only. And they looked at the first recorded blood glucose on the day of the surgical procedure. My first question is, why is this blood level being drawn on the day of surgery? Typically, I get them prior to surgery or I get them after surgery. But if I do it in the pre-op area, it's normally because I'm concerned about something. So we ask
that. You're big time.
So that's probably a question I asked the joint surgeon. The surgeon goes, I don't know. I don't typically get those. So we'll start that. Now, I will say that one of our initiatives at one of our hospitals is to get that on every single patient. But most hospitals don't have that initiative for all their patients. Next, how do you identify patients as diabetic and non-diabetic? This is the Premier Healthcare Database. We're not necessarily looking at these ICD-9 or ICD-10 codes. Are these just based on patients with diabetic or anti-diabetic medications? But patients were designated as diabetic and non-diabetic, and it wasn't clearly defined as to why they were designated as that.
And what if they're diabetic and they don't know it?
That's the hardest one, right? And not, you're looking at day of surgery sugars, not preoperative sugars or anything like that, or hemoglobin A1Cs. So yes. Hidden diabetics in this study could ruin things. So they looked at 90-day PJI risk, and they evaluated by multivariable logistic regression with restricted cubic splines. So first, I would like to know why only 90 days, which I would love to see this up to 1 year for PJI risk. And asking my methodology expert and guru, what are restricted cubic splines?
This is just a way to try to methodologically account for the number of factors that are, they're trying to have a more conservative model around this because there are a lot of unknowns. It's a methodologic approach. I don't think it gives any like extra assurance that somehow this data is somewhat better than if they didn't do that.
Perfect. Thanks for the clarification. The authors also looked at other wound and medical complications, along with 90-day readmission and in-hospital mortality. Patients with and without diabetes, again with the definition, with a preoperative blood glucose level associated with 1.5 times greater odds of PJI, high preoperative blood glucose levels, were then compared with patients with normal preoperative blood glucose levels. I'm curious as to why the 1.5 cutoff and why that was significant and why that was used. And areas that you'll know way better than I do are they use the stats of multivariable models accounting for potential confounding covariates who were created using iterative minimization of the Akagi information criterion and the Bayesian information criterion.
So there are all sorts of different ways in which you can decide to, you know, what you're going to adjust for in a model. They're using a more quantitative approach with those factors. You can do a conceptual model where you say, I don't care how these factors perform, I'm going to include them in the model no matter what. There's not really a wrong answer here because the sample is so large. I mean, they're approaching 100,000 patients. They're a little bit over 90,000 anyway, nonetheless. So that's just the way they went about it with their methodology. There isn't, it's not necessarily wrong. But the same thing I said before, I don't think that, you know, means that this data is somehow somewhat better. It's just dealer's choice in terms of how you want to construct your confounding. You're going to be limited in what you can adjust for confounding wise in this context because this is claims-based data. In many respects, ICD-based data, I'm sure that they will say, well, it's not entirely claims-based data because they have the lab values. So granted, like I will give them that. And that part is useful, but you don't know the indication bias around why were those labs drawn that day? And you don't know the selection bias around, and this is probably my biggest reservation, is that on all of these cases, the surgeon said, yeah, sure, we can deal with that. You know, full speed ahead, damn the torpedoes. Like, but there are other cases, presumably, where there was a glucose value that the case was canceled. The anesthesia put the case on hold, permanent hold, or like hold till next month or until you get your blood sugars under control. And then, you know, the biggest one, I think in this context, is if the patient doesn't tell you they have diabetes and then they have high blood glucose, right? Or they don't tell you because they don't know, not that they're hiding something.
Oh, right. And the surprise. So this could ruin all of it,
though. Well, but see, in this case, they have in the diabetes patients, this is the cutoff. In the non-diabetes patients, this is the cutoff. But what if it's a patient who says, I don't have diabetes, but you're like, you know what? I think you have diabetes. And they're like, no, I don't have diabetes. I want you to use the lower cutoff. You're like, no, but I think you have diabetes and we're going to use the higher cutoff.
This would be a bad conversation to have with patients because I don't want to fight them about this. It's called surprise diabetes. We need a new category. There's type 1, type 2, and surprise diabetes. Congratulations. And also that's a category of pre-diabetics, things like that, right? But patients don't always know. So this did include, as you said, to your point, a huge database, over 90,000 patients, 90,830 patients. 22.5 had a preoperative diagnosis of diabetes. They said 77.5% did not, but of those, we do not know who did or did not have it. The mean preoperative blood glucose level of the patients who were designated as diabetic was 143. Of those patients who were classified as having diabetes, they said that 44.4% had a normal preoperative blood glucose defined as 80 to 130, and their mean preoperative blood glucose was 110, whereas only 1.7% of patients had a high preoperative blood glucose with a preoperative blood glucose of 328. And then my question that follows that is, were those patients undergoing surgery or not? And maybe that's why they were checking for the blood glucose level in the first place. It was a tiny percentage of people, but not a lot.
All these patients got the surgery. They're not in this data set if they didn't get the surgery.
That's true. They underwent surgery and they just had really, really high blood glucose level. Exactly. You're right. Good point. Did not think about that. And so these patients with these high preoperative blood glucose levels were male and had shorter length of stay, surprisingly enough. And the admitting hospitals for patients with these high preoperative blood glucose levels were commonly rural and teaching and located in the South. And they had more concomitant systemic illnesses, which is not surprising. Whereas the normal preoperative group had higher rates of uncomplicated diabetes, which is interesting. So these normal preoperative blood glucose patients had higher rates of uncomplicated diabetes and hypertension. So you're separating these groups into diabetic, non-diabetic, and then high and low, and then they all cross over in between.
It is such a messy, like, And again, all of this has to do with the fact that you don't have the granular on the ground examination of, I'm going to go and prospectively survey these individuals and each individual. Now, can you do that to 90,000 patients? Of course not. But I'm just saying, where it's hypothetically, it's like, I know for a fact that this is this patient's story and that is that patient's story. Here, it's just, you know, what is miscoded? What was selection? What was a surveillance bias? What was, you know, we were expecting that and we'll manage it versus we weren't expecting that, but we'll just go ahead anyway at a hospital where they're better equipped to manage these kinds of things versus one where there aren't. I mean, there are just so many confounding factors circulating around this.
Way too many. And so to your point, they conclude, again, these two different levels of patients with diabetes, the cutoff is 277 versus 193 in patients without diabetes. They did say patients with high blood glucose, preoperative blood glucose levels had increased odds of PJI. That was their take-home message, an odds ratio of 2.6. And it differed for patients with diabetes or without diabetes. And they had increased risk of 90-day readmission, an odds ratio of 1.9. And again, it differed. So it was 1.9 for patients with diabetes and 1.6 for patients without diabetes. They said there was no difference or no significant difference with regards to non-infectious wound complications and 90-day in-hospital mortality. The high preoperative blood glucose level had higher adjusted odds ratio of PJI of 2.7 compared to the high normal group with diabetes.
I have a headache. I will tell you that this also kind of plays into where you talk about these kinds of scenarios and people will say, well, it's in the regression model, so it's accounted for, it's adjusted for. But like, the regression models are not magic. They can only work with what you're giving them. So if there's all of these kind of, you know, they did things that, I'm not talking about collinear variables, but I'm just talking about clinical truncation, where a lot of the same people are in one cohort versus in a different cohort. Just the fact that it's included as an adjuster, a yes-no variable, especially when you're talking about what is essentially a spectrum linear continuous data, that they're creating these cutoffs, I think that's very problematic. And I think that the clinical application for this, those who want to apply this clinically, I think you have to do it with extreme caution. Because I would represent to you that someone with a blood glucose of 276 is not safer than one with 277. Right. And that's what they're saying here. If it's below 276 and you know they're diabetic, you're good to go.
Fine.
And I would argue that someone with a blood glucose of 192, whether they're diabetic, if they're not diabetic, why is their blood glucose so high?
Yeah. And that's the thing, is that delineating superficially, I guess, would you say, between diabetic and non-diabetic is not the point here, is looking at these blood glucose levels, period, is I think the key factor.
And I think that's the clinically relevant question here, is like whether the patient has an ICD code or not that says, oh, they received a code for diabetes, or, oh, this one didn't. Like, don't you asking you, because you're making these decisions as the total hip surgeon, you know, don't you really just care what their blood glucose is? If they're like, no, the patient's not diabetic, their blood glucose is 193 or 192, we're good.
No, that's the biggest problem. I'd rather have that. And that's how you diagnose those patients who are undiagnosed. So there you go. I think we put that case on hold.
Yeah, its blood glucose was above 193 and 277 at the same time. So the case is on hold.
I think while you were talking, your blood glucose spiked to about 400 in the midst of you talking. Just saying. So without further ado, we're going to go to our honorable mentions. We're going to go with the dual growing rods and apical control technique for treating congenital early onset scoliosis, lessons learned by Wang et al. There's also a commentary on this. In the study of 41 patients, we observed that both apical control technique and traditional dual growing rods and traditional growing rods only could correct the deformity while allowing for spinal growth in patients with congenital early onset scoliosis. This apical control technique with traditional dual growing rods yielded better correction in severe cases and did not have a deleterious effect on spinal heights, but further studies are needed in this area. An evaluation of the reliability of manual landmark identification on 3D segmented wrists by Winter et al. It is permanently free. The goal of the study was to evaluate the reliability of the determination of anatomical points placed manually on 3D models of the radius to determine which of these points allowed for reliable morphometric measurements. They used 23 radial scans and they were reconstructed into 3D. And the authors found that the use of isolated points were actually insufficient for the development of a wrist reference frame, especially for the purpose of measuring dorsal palmar tilt. If one concurs that an error of 2% is unacceptable for all distal radius measures, then clinicians should avoid using 3D landmarked points due to the unreliability. The only one that potentially could be used is radial inclination, measured using the radial styloid and the midpoint of the ulnar edge of the radius. The impact of social determinants of health on outcomes and complications after total knee arthroplasty, an analysis of neighborhood deprivation indices. This is by Raman et al., and it is free for 30 days. The purpose of the study was to investigate the relationship between outcomes following total knee arthroplasty and both the social vulnerability index and the area deprivation index. The study found that greater deprivation based on multiple social vulnerability index subthemes, the composite social vulnerability index, and the area deprivation index was significantly associated with increased length of stay, non-home discharge emergency department visits, and readmission. The social vulnerability index and the area deprivation index may be important considerations in the perioperative assessment of patients who undergo total knee arthroplasty. Thanks so much for joining us again for another Your Case is on Hold, and we look forward to seeing you again shortly.